I was going to say, right minds think alike, because the Commune and Barrier decided to hold a meeting on anarchism, Marxism and the state, and as a communist workers' organisation to which I belong, we came up with a similar idea. We were going to say, is Marxism and anarchism the real divide in the revolutionary movement today? And when it was clear on Facebook that there was two groups with a similar kind of meeting, I suggested that perhaps we could meet together, not knowing who the other group was at the time. I was very happy to find it was the Commune and Barry, who I've only met once before today, which was in a Commune meeting in London. We immediately just exchanged a few emails, and Barry got the short straw because he's going to talk first, and I got the best straw because I'm going to just going to make up whatever I say after he's talking. But he speaks for 25 minutes, I'll speak for 5 seconds.
10 minutes.
What he doesn't say, I'll try and add. And that's how we're going to introduce the meeting, then we'll throw it open to discussion.
Yeah, so the question is, was Bakunin right in 1870 or thereabouts when he said the great divide, the revolution divide is this: on the one hand, you've got the revolutionary anarchists who believe in the self-emancipation of the masses from below and want to destroy the state. On the other hand, you've got the communist left, the Marxist left, who stand for a people's state, who stand for a worker's state, who stand for a different kind of state that's just going to end up in authoritarianism and dictatorship over workers. Now, it was a critique against Marx, but when you look at the polemic, Marx and the state, if you look at his polemic in 1870 or thereabouts, it's not a direct critique of Marx, and there's no quotes from Marx. Basically what he does, it's an indirect quote or indirect polemic where his argument goes something like this. Marx is the Pope of German social democracy. He's the greatest theoretical influence on German social democracy. Therefore, whatever LaSalle and the state socialists of social democracy stand for, Marx stands for that. And he was saying this in 1870. Now, we'll come to it in a minute, but in the 1870s, Marx didn't stand for state socialism. But what Bakunin did was to refer back to the Communist Manifesto in 1848. So he's going back, he's not dealing with Marx's views in the 1870s, he's going back to 1848, the Communist Manifesto, and there you have it. State socialism, and here it is. The proletariat will use its political supremacy to wrest by degrees all capital from the bourgeoisie, to centralise all instruments of production in the hands of the state, or the proletariat organised as a ruling class. And there you have it, state socialism. Now, I'm a revolutionary communist, revolutionary Marxist, comrades from the CWOR. We don't agree with that. So we're not talking about revolutionary gods here. We're not talking about people who are theoretically right, who suck theory out of their thumbs or their theories just came in their head. This was written in an historical context of 1848, the beginnings of modern capitalism, modern industrial capitalism. It hadn't rolled out across Europe, let alone the world. So this is at the beginning, at the time Marx didn't fully understand what the nature of capitalism was. So you're dealing with a very early document, and one of the biggest proletarian movements or workers' movements at the time was Chartism, and they did believe in perfecting the state. They had a demand for annual parliaments. So that was the level that the movement was at, and this reflects that. Okay. So later, and we'll come to it, in a preface in the 1870s, Marx quite clearly says, we were wrong about that. It's historically outdated. But in the 1870s, Bakunin was still harping back to 1848. Now, as I say, Marx learned to generalise from workers' struggles, but Bakunin had a lot of insights. In 1848, he'd already worked out the revolution can't pass through the state. He didn't have a fully worked out theory, but he had a few insights. So, as against Marx, he was right there with that insight about not going through the state. So, but Marx, he quickly picked up on the question of the state, because Bakunin was making the point, or going on about, the state being very, very powerful, in some cases more powerful than classes in some situations. And when Marx looked at the history of France, the 18th Brumaire, he did this historical article when he was looking at a situation where the state proves stronger than the classes, and it balanced between classes. So there, he learnt about the power of the state, and it's there that he abandoned the view that the working class has to conquest the state, has to conquer power within the state. He abandoned that view and said the state had to be smashed. And that was certainly Marx's position on the Paris Commune. Absolutely clear about it. Now, if you listen, say, to a leader of one of the Leninist groups, they don't like this writing on the Paris Commune because it's too Bakuninite. And I can't really see much difference between Bakunin and Marx on the question of state, because this is Marx's lesson from the Paris Commune. What was it? It was a revolution against the state. What was it? The state is the domination of capital over labour, exploitation and oppression. So what is the lesson of the Commune? It's the self-government of the producers, the self-emancipation of the working class from below. Now that's the revolutionary Marxist position. We're in favour of destroying the state, because if you have the state, then you can't have an alternative society to capitalism. So Bakunin's polemic, with all due respect to Bakunin, was misleading. But Bakunin did get a few things right. For example, in the Communist Manifesto, the beginnings, as I say, of modern capitalism, before it had rolled out across the world, Marx was thinking that it would roll out and flatten all the reactionary feudal stuff. But it didn't, like in Germany, because faced with the threat of the masses from below, conservatives and reactionaries decided to modernise themselves. So the Junkers in Germany, landed aristocrats, modernised Germany from above in a reactionary way. And Marx was a bit slow to pick up on that. He's still talking about advance for the centralised state in Germany. Would be advance for workers, we'd develop the working class and so on. And he was wrong about that. And I think Bakunin said, some people think that Roman imperialism was impressive, but I'm against Roman imperialism. I think it's all bad. And he did have a point there about imperialism, whereas I think Marx, in 1848, was looking at imperialism, capitalist civilization as being wholly progressive or mainly progressive. But he changed his mind about that on Ireland. History taught him Ireland and India that imperialism wasn't wholly progressive, wasn't wholly a progressive force. So, the differences between Marx and Bakunin there narrow. Now, at the same time that Bakunin was polemicising against Marx, saying Marx was pro-state, he was for a people's state and so on, Marx had already criticised Lasallian state socialism, German state socialism. They stood for the even had a newspaper called The People's State, as if the people could represent the masses' interests. And he rubbished it. If you read the critique of the Gotha programme, if you read that critique, he just rubbishes the idea of state socialism in it. Now, the problem is, I think, he did it privately, which was wrong. You know, all leaders of any political organisation deserve to be criticised, publicly and privately. And he kept quiet and didn't publicise the criticism until, I think, the 1890s or thereabouts. So, it's excusable, I suppose, for Bakunin not to know that he rubbished state socialism and rubbished LaSalle and German social democracy. But there are a few ambiguous statements in the critique of the Gotha programme. It's not entirely, it doesn't repeat the language of the lessons of the Paris Commune. It's not, you don't get the revolutionary rhetoric, but it's like private correspondence. He wants to influence these German social democrats, but he doesn't have much influence, so he's got to be careful. So he does talk about, you know, the transitional society being based on the old society, not based on the old state, but the old society. So there's a bit of ambiguity there. And it's an ambiguity that the Leninist tradition or the Bolshevik tradition took up, because they were very much influenced by social democracy. I mean, Trotsky was certainly a Lassallian, state socialist, labour dictator. And if you look at Lenin, if you look at the State and Revolution, right, for a lot of the time he's talking about, this is the lesson, revolutionary Marxism means smashing the state. And you think, well, that's great. And, you know, for a while it looks really good, he's saying, we have to smash the state, we're not in any way in favour of the state. But then he starts talking about the basis of the old regime, and he interprets it to mean the basis of the old state. So you smash the capitalist state, and then, and this is where social democracy comes in, you build another state. You build a worker state, which is a variation of the people's state. Trotsky in the worker state, nationalisation equals worker state, all that rubbish, okay? And he also talks about capitalism itself preparing the groundwork for the worker state. So advanced capitalism gives you the economic framework. So you've got the post office, and he actually gives this example of the post office. So socialism is a post office with Lenin in charge. So, and then, but more, you know, kind of more serious, he takes the phrase dictatorship of the proletariat that Marx uses in the Critique of the Gotha Program. It's just one phrase, I think he might have used it once or twice. It means in context, and loads of academics have produced the quotes, it means for Marx the domination of society by the working class. But in the Russian Marxist tradition, Plekhanov and Lenin, they interpret dictatorship of the proletariat as a government, as a state government. So workers' state, workers' government, dictatorship of the proletariat is the government in state power. Now, that's the lesson of the Russian Revolution. The Bolsheviks went into the Russian Revolution with a social democratic program, the minimum program, perfecting the state, the capitalist state, constituent assembly, right, 8-hour day, other minimal demands. The masses themselves were far more advanced, trampled all that underfoot, and then so Lenin came up with something. He was hiding away in an area of safety, as he usually did in these situations, and he produced, you know, the state and revolution. Now, it wasn't any influence on Bolshevism prior to 1917, and it certainly wasn't any influence on Bolshevism after 1917, because the day after 1917, the day after the revolution, then they rooted power in subnarchum, rooted power in the party leadership and the state. Insofar as the state was damaged, they brought back the old state officials, they worked with the old army officers, and so on. And all the economic stuff was bodies set up very similar to the Tsarist regime, where all the stuff would come down from the top and all the workers' power from below would be dissolved. So it wasn't rooted in the mass workers' organisations in the Soviets. Now, Viktor Serge, who was a Bolshevik for a while, was a Trotskyist for a while, was an anarchist for a while, yeah, he was pretty much a lot of things for a while, but he kind of summed it all up when he said, what was wrong with the Russian Revolution, what was wrong with Bolshevism? It lacked the spirit of liberty. And that's what most of the oppositions, not talking about the Trotskyist left opposition, which wasn't a real opposition that related to the masses outside the party, but it was a leadership split with Stalin. I'm talking about the real oppositions, and there were many of them. Can't go into it all here, you'd have to read it. But they all stress one theme, that is, that the Bolshevik regime had lost confidence in the self, creativity and initiative of the masses. And that was the main lesson of the Russian Revolution. Now, as a revolutionary Marxist, I'd like to finish by quoting Bakunin, because I absolutely agree with these words as a revolutionary Marxist. And here they are. Liberty can only be created by liberty, by an insurrection of all the people and the voluntary organisation of the workers from below upward. And that's in a nutshell, is the programme of the Commune as well, and we're Marxists.
Thanks, Dave. Obviously, I'll say something and then everybody else can chip in as they like. I agree with much what Barry was saying there. I think the decline of the Russian Revolution is a slightly more complicated issue, but I don't want to go into a historiographical exercise. I don't think that the state and revolution was the best thing that Lenin ever did against the state. The best thing he ever did was in the first few months after the revolution, when he went around touring factories saying, we can't make the revolution, only the working class can make it. If you read Neil Harding's Lenin's Political Thought, he's got a whole series of these quotations of Lenin's speeches in factories, which you won't find in English, apart from in that source. But the fact is that by March 1918, when the Civil War is about to start and the Bolsheviks are forced to sign the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, the question of the nature of the Soviet state is already in question. And I absolutely agree with Barry. Mistake number one was to follow what the Mensheviks did. When Soviet power was established in November 7, 1917, what the Bolsheviks' first big mistake was to do was to establish this, the Council of People's Commissar, what Barry referred to by its Russian name as Sovnarkom. This was actually just another cabinet of a traditional nature, and it only sounded revolutionary because Trotsky had the brainwave to call them commissars instead of ministers, and that's why it got its name and sounded a bit revolutionary. But in actual fact, the revolution already had its critics within the Bolshevik Party. This book came out last year. Well, it's been in Russian, of course, for 80 or 90 years, but all the editions of the paper called Communist, which was the paper of the Russian left communist opposition inside the Bolshevik Party, have now been translated into French. And they're the first people to actually say to Lenin, if you carry on like this, you're taking us to state capitalism. And Lenin's reply was, well, state capitalism would be a good thing, because it'd be better than what we've got now. And this is one of the big problems, is that not only for some Marxists do they see state capitalism as socialism, but even when they don't, they think that state capitalism is somehow a step towards socialism, when in actual fact we now have 80 years of history to tell us that it's one of the last bastions. And in fact, I would argue that we live in a global state capitalist regime of various degrees, and that this has been what has dominated bourgeois as well as Russian political frameworks since the revolution. So these people were the first Marxists who actually began to criticise the notion of state capitalism. It was then taken up by councillors in Germany like Otto Ruhler, who in 1921 said that Russia had become state capitalist. And the notion state capitalist now became a discussion of general currency amongst the left, the communist left. Our organisation is descended from that discussion. In the 1920s, we were the only people who fought inside the Comintern against its degeneration, for which after we'd founded the Italian Communist Party, for which our leaders were expelled. And of course, in Italy, most of our leaders ended up in jail because they were against fascism as well. And so for the next 20 years, they're fighting in the jails of fascism or in exile abroad to try to re-establish an anti-statist Marxist programme. At the end of the war, they establish an internationalist communist party, not a national party in any sense, because they're against all national parties, and they establish it specifically on the aim of attacking state capitalism and various other things. But one of the big weaknesses was that the leader of the old party, was called Amedeo Bordiga, came back, and he started arguing that the revolution is made only by the party is the state, and that the party will set up the workers' councils from above below. So this led to a split in 1952. So all those people, two or three people have asked me today, are you Bordigists? I can quite safely say, no, we are the opposite of Bordigists. And it was in opposition to Bordigism that we were established. Returning to the topic, I actually got the inspiration for the meeting from reading the Solfège pamphlet. I don't know if anybody has read it. I know the comrades of the AF have reviewed it, but I've only just bought the review, so I haven't seen it. But I read this in it. This is from Fighting for Ourselves by Solfège. In the early 20th century, bosses and the state began to react to the gains of the CGT, the Confédération Générale du Travail, with a more conciliatory attitude. This increased the space for reformists to operate as class collaboration could be seen to bear fruit. By 1909, the growth of the union had put the revolutionaries in a minority. The CGT grew from 100,000 members in 1902 to 700,000 in 1912, out of a population of 7 million. The population of France in that time was 35 million, perhaps meaning the working class. Victor Griffouet resigned as General Secretary amidst machinations against him, and Emile Pouget, who left the Union disillusioned. The slide into class collaboration, reformism and bureaucratisation was crowned by the CGT's support for the national war effort in 1914. This was the most decisive break with its revolutionary internationalist origins. And I read that and I thought, that's just like what happened to the Marxist movement. Social democracy got gradually more and more reformist, got gradually more and more. In fact, Nick in his talk mentioned Mirand, Joy, Simon. These people became ministers in the French government, and Mirand was the first, in fact, to actually identify the Marxist socialist tendency with the state directly. And so it made me think, oh great, so the anarchists also had their reformist tendencies, they've also had to shake them out. And of course in the Spanish Civil War, the big problem in the Spanish Civil War was that the anarchists betrayed their own principles. You know, we were talking about Garcia Oliveira earlier today, who said that when the CNT entered the Catalan government, it was the most transcendental day in the history of the Spanish proletariat. They also said that when they joined the Madrid government, they said, oh, this is a excellent step forward, and now the state is in the process of being no longer a problem because we're in it. And of course there's a disaster, and Camilo Berneri, the Italian anarchist who was in Spain at the time, completely criticised this and denounced it. But of course, like the Russian Revolution, the Spanish Revolution was trying to fight in a time of reaction and isolation, and in both of them the revolutionaries failed to keep to their principles. And it strikes me that keeping to your principles is the key role of any revolutionary in any movement. The abandonment for short-term gain is absolutely the most fundamental betrayal of everything that you stand for. And I think this has an issue for today, because today we're facing, and I'm 65, an unprecedented attack on the living standards of the working class that we've seen on a global basis in my lifetime. Obviously I was brought up during the boom years of the post-war years, and since then it's been shit all the way. Since 1973, capitalism has been in crisis. Today, that crisis has reached its apogee because the speculative bubble has burst. So they attack, they can do nothing else to attack us. It won't do them any good. They can reduce us to absolute penury, and they will still have a capitalist crisis. Our consumption can be zero, and they'll still have a capitalist crisis, because that is part of the contradiction of capitalism, which I won't go into today. But it then poses a question. Most people, I bet, have been involved in some anti-cuts and activities in their area in this room. But we've been trying to go to anti-cuts movements and saying, let's fight the cuts. Let's fight for what we need now. Let's fight for Stocksbridge Legislature, as my comrade was doing last week. But at the same time, we also have to pose what is the greater goal. Because if we aren't going to spread the consciousness that we've got to the rest of the humanity, we can't do it by being silent. We have to insert a revolutionary perspective into all of those struggles. We are not just fighting the cuts. We are fighting capitalism, and we're fighting the state. And those two monsters have to be slain at the same time. And that's basically all we are trying to do. And Barry started with the Communist Manifesto. And I'll just finish with one little phrase from it. The communists disdain to conceal their aims. We have to be open and honest. All the Trotskyists who've had all these fancy games all these years, all these Trotskyist transitional demands, all these Trotskyists, oh, we can't tell the working class that they should be fighting socially because they don't want that, so we'll tell them to fight for something else, and when they get it, we'll tell them they're wrong. And that's been the methodology of Trotskyism since its inception. This is why we say, or that's why I'm saying, that the divide today isn't between Marxists like Barry and the CWO and the Commune and the anarchists. The division is between those Marxists who are still fighting for a reformist agenda and also those anarchists who are, and I'm pleased to see that many anarchists have criticised those who participated in the Occupy movement, who are also criticising other anarchists for their lack of political clarity in what are the initial, or hopefully will be the initial, organisations which are springing up in response to the capitalist crisis. These proceedings are now
So are the two of you maintaining that there are no differences, or were you saying within sections of both there is this possibility for more cooperation and more communication, and what are some of the conclusions that you draw from what you both have said?
We've only got 1 hour for the meeting, so the meeting is entitled, you know, the differences on the state, so focus, you know, is on the state, because a lot of young anarchists say to themselves, look, there's something in Marxism that leads to state socialism. But my response would be, well, if you look at Spain in 1936-37, there the anarchist leaders helped to reconstruct the state against their own people, against the workers' revolution from below. And they rebuilt the state with the Stalinists and the bourgeois republicans, or the capitalist republican politicians. Was there something in anarchism that led to that? No. As you've just said, it's about how do you chart your way through that situation and keep your anti-state views rather than go for some shortcuts that just end up with another form of state or another form of oppression. I think another reason why anarchists sometimes think Marxists stand for state socialism is the influence of Trotskyism in Britain. I mean, if you look at the Trotskyist left, all of them stand for some kind of people's state, or to use the jargon, a workers' government. That's a workers' government based on a capitalist state, by the way. So historically, that's been a left Labour government. You fight for the left Labour government. And then that's the way forward. And a lot of them still have that view, but now it's gone over to dreaming about a British Syriza. We can build a British Syriza, and then we can have a workers' government based on a capitalist state. And somehow or other, that will lead to transforming capitalism through the capitalist state. If there's a Syriza government in Greece, I can tell you now that would be disastrous for the working class. It would completely disillusion people, and it will lead to a right-wing fascist or authoritarian solution on the streets. I mean, all these latest groups like the Left Unity and the Anti-Capitalist Initiative, they're the same type of people they're talking about. It's all about tactics for them. So what are their real convictions? You'll never know, because you never know what their convictions are. They're so used to placing their convictions on one side. Tactics, vote Labour. Tactics, support left Labour. Tactics, support some kind of Syriza reformist party. Tactics, so they live their tactics, so what happens to their principles then? What happens to their convictions? Well, they get left behind, that's what happens to them. And they discredit Marxism. They've built no social roots. The disintegration of the main parties in Greece comes from the left. Disintegration in Britain comes from the right, UKIP, where poor working class people, out of desperation and poverty, are voting for UKIP, because the Marxist left has never built any, never sunk deep social roots.
Just, because you were sorry, but Barry, I think, starts off by saying, I'm not going to answer your questions, you want to talk about the state. But once you go over that bit, I have a feeling he did answer your question, and he answered this, I think he answered it positively. And for me, I think the experience is that the dividing lines that exist now means that in practical terms, there's a lot more that unites the people in this room than that does provide ways where we look at working together, and we do look at practical ways. I think that's what Barry said, in fact, by saying where's the real dividing line. The real dividing line isn't because people call themselves Marxists, because unfortunately the majority of people who call themselves Marxists in Britain are completely tied to this reformist strategy and to state capitalism. And they openly say we want more state intervention, we want more state ownership, we want to move back towards state ownership because that's some sort of way forward. So those were sort of revolutionary Marxists who have nothing in common with that. Certainly are looking where we can practically work together with revolutionary anarchists who also share an understanding of the answer to capitalism's crisis isn't more state intervention, it's the working class struggling to actually transcend the state.
Who's Jim?
John Keeley. I'm from the commune as well, so I'll be quite open with my allegiances. Pick up on a point of another area where libertarian communists, council communists, have common ground with anarchists, is on the question of the division of labour. But it's not just having common ownership. If you've still got doctors, lawyers, and you've still got people with street cleaners, then you're going to have elites, you're going to have that hierarchy, you're going to have people with more power than the others. So I think we also need to address the issue of the division of labour. We need to abolish that if you genuinely want equality. But just one other point I'd like to make is all what we've heard is a lot of history, and it's the relevance of that today. Now, where we're all coming from, by and large, by being anti-state, what does that actually mean today? Well, for me, that means that the main focus shouldn't be getting elected. And the main focus should be trying to build local councils, local communes, local Soviets, local assemblies, whatever we want to call them. Because if you are going to have common ownership, and you are going to abolish the division of labour, what kind of society is that? What institutions are going to be there? You need these local councils where the power really is. It's direct democracy in a way, in form. It may take different colours and variations depending on what issues, but in essence that has to be democratic, it has to be right from the roots, from the people. So I think that's another area that's in common. I think the big debate is, do you ignore elections completely? Do you ignore trade unions completely? Or do you somehow try to influence and somehow try to engage with them as well?
Actually, you answered most of what, well, you talked about what you wanted to talk about. I think, you know, the two speakers, you referred to this generic idea of the state, but I think, you know, I think you should differentiate between the capitalist state, which I would totally agree that Marx said, that, and I think we, you know, any revolution should say cannot be used for revolution purposes. It has to be smashed. There's nothing in it for us. We don't want to gain control of it. We want to destroy it. But also, for me, the Marxist definition of the state is a mechanism for the suppression, the oppression of another class. And the fact is that we do need a mechanism for the suppression of the ruling class. So we cannot really simply say we are against the state. we are not against a mechanism for the suppression of the ruling class. We are completely for a mechanism for the suppression of the ruling class. Yes, you know, in that sense, we are not anarchists in the sense that we oppose all authority. You know, we want to impose our authority on the people who are actually keeping us down. Yeah, the ruling class. But I think what we need to recognise is that the state that we want, or what we precisely call the semi-state, is exactly what the chap was referring to behind me. It's the power of the class-wide bodies, the power of, referred to them as communes, workers' councils. I've even heard the term territorial syndicate. Yes, but we do need a class-wide body, a class-wide mechanism to keep down the ruling class, which, and that in my mind, means that we do need a form of state. We are not anti-state per se.
But this is like playing with words.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
the state, we're told there will have to be, to suppress the ruling class, a civil war. Or in fact, the more people are involved in overthrowing the present system, the less war and the less violence there need to be. It's assuming the worst, and there is an open civil war. We will only win if we win over some of the old functions of the old state to abandon their place. But we don't want to put them into a new state. But we want, what we've got, as you said, are class-wide bodies which control everything, and that's the key to it. It's the key to why Marxists can talk of a semi-state, because it's a state that's withering away. It has functions. Only state is functions only at the point of suppression of the present ruling class. Once you go beyond this, those functions are unnecessary, and therefore you have to have them. It's only the classified bodies that can do it. It's only that come from below.
Well, is it then?
Just
a very quick point. Nick can go first. Sorry, I think you had a second.
Well, this does actually show the differences between Marxists and some Marxists,
yes,
and anarchists, you know, some Marxists and anarchists. The fact, you know, the misunderstanding about what the state is an insurmountable question. What is this idea of the semi-state? You know, the state is a form of repression. Does the semi-state mean that I'm going to be semi-repressed? Does it mean I'm going to be semi-put in prison? Does it mean I'm going to be semi-shot? I think it's a really vague idea. As to the influence of Marx on anarchists, well, I'm not a young anarchist, I'm an old anarchist. And of course I'm influenced by the best ideas of Marx. I'd be a fool not to be, you know. But I think Bakunin was right about what Marxism became in the main. And it wasn't Jacobinized Marxism, you know, in the form of Bolshevism. In the mainstream of Marxism is social democracy. It was the mainstream in Germany, it was the mainstream in Austria, and it was the mainstream in France and Italy as well. I mean, and then of course you get the Jacobinized forms of social democracy, you know, around Lenin and Trotsky. And there is a small current within Marxism with which I share many similar positions, you know, left communists and council communists, but they are actually a minority within Marxism, I'd say. And I think, you know, Bakunin was right about Lassallian. Social democracy, Marxism in the main became that form, I'd say.
Don't disagree with you. That's
good.
Yeah. Did you want to say something?
Yeah. Basically, the point you made, that you know, we need to create a state, and you then said, well, but that's a game of words. We need a civil war, and the more consensus there is, the less violence. I think, but for me, that is also a contradiction, because if you say we need a civil war and we don't have that consensus, the white consensus, then the consequences of a civil war is the establishment of a new state. So that is also a game of war. Because historically, that has been the case. Whenever there's been a violent civil war, there's always been a reaction, and the reaction is always establishing of a new state. So For me, and I remember the first time I ever met Trotsky, I said, you know, for me, the real revolution will be when we will do things peacefully. Because if there isn't a peaceful way to go about it, it will always be actually a creation of a new state that we don't want, after all. I mean, I'm going tomorrow to... I volunteer for the Davos Employee Worker Center, and we deal with the people who suffer the worst consequences of what's happening now every day. For me, you said something about what is the greatest goal, or what is the most urgent goal, I would ask. And I would argue that the most urgent goal for me is to protect actually the most vulnerable, the one who's suffering the most. I mean, for me, it's important not to forget that. Tomorrow, I'm sent to London to meet some... activists from Germany and Spain trying to find a way to kind of fight the bedroom tax. And I was looking for inspiration here, perhaps. So what you know? And my question is, what is the most urgent goal?
We'll answer you later.
Okay. Sorry, I apologize if I need to leave because my son is indicated he wants to go, so I might have to leave soon. Sorry.
So I have two questions, but. I want to kind of put it as a disclaimer that I broadly agree with the kind of conciliatory sentiment here, but I've got two criticisms basically which I think need to be explored. The first is that I agree with kind of Barry's broad analysis that the comparable analysis between Marxism and anarchism in terms of the anarchists taking up government posts and Marxists taking up government posts, like, you know, that logic can work both ways. But is it not the case that, at least in classic Marx, that there is a certain historical determinism, like this idea of inevitability in his writings, that lends a stronger case to the kind of wait and see, war reform, revolution will happen around the corner, contrary to the anarchist thinkers who have always criticized that position? You know, we need revolution now. So I just thought it would be useful to put that out there. The second point was more in reaction to what was said about, I don't really want to talk about the semi-state question, but in terms of the civil war idea, I guess I would find myself in disagreement with that analysis, in the sense that communization has to be a process. And militarism is very much contrary to the spirit of communization. And I think if social transformations have reached the point where there has been a militarization of the struggle, as in there are being armies constructed on each side, then the revolution has failed. You know, communization is about transference of the means of production to a point that the ruling class cannot defend its privileges anymore. And I think we have to talk about it in those absolute terms. When we talk about, you know, the eruption of the Spanish Civil War and the Russian Civil War, to me that's the point where the revolution has already failed.
I don't think I can agree with that historically. I mean, in Spain, in fact, a lot of exciting things happened during the Civil War. But I do agree with the political point that people are making about the Civil War. Given the level of technology, of armaments, you do not want to have a Civil War. You will not have a country left. We've got to recognize this. We're in a different era, right? This is not Spain in 1936. There's just way too many explosives out there. So, and I think actually John McClane came up with a pretty good formula, which was that violence is incidental to the revolution. The revolution's main thrust has to be nonviolent, and it certainly cannot lead into a civil war. We get that, I'm certainly right. We get to the point where the two armies fighting each other, there aren't going to be a country left. We won't have to worry about whether it is, you know, state or not. It's going to be leveled. Look at Syria. What a mess. So I agree entirely with that. And I also do think that the point that the mainstream of Marxism moved in a reformist point is something, I'm a Marxist of a very unorthodox sort, has to be taken into account, because there are parts of Marx that do tend to lend themselves to it. Part of that is the sort of inevitability argument. You can find other parts of Marx, but there are parts of Marx where it tends to lean in that way. Bad road to go down. But I think all of us in this room who consider ourselves Marxists, we're not Bible Marxists, you know? It's not like Marx had the right answer to everything. It was a long time ago. He made lots of mistakes. he was a human being. Move on, you know? And I think the anarchists have said a lot of good things. We should learn from that as well. I do think, and I guess actually I have sort of disagreements with both Marxists and anarchists on this. I don't think the state is just a question of repression. It's a much more complicated thing than that. There's going to be a process by which we go from a revolution to a society that John's talking about, which doesn't have classes. That's not going to happen overnight. And in that, and we're not going to immediately enter an economy in which everything is, all goods are available to everyone in any amount they want. I'm not even sure that's given, you know, the Earth's limited supply of resources that we'll ever attain that process, but for sure it won't be immediate. These are complex questions that are going to have to be dealt with in a collective kind of way. Call it whatever you want. It's going to be involve some process of decision making, which I would call state. I don't know. Semi. I don't really care what you want to call it, but it involves much more than just repression. So, that's a again another problem with Marx. He didn't write much about what a social society would like. A kind of, you know, little cryptic notes written. You know, don't really do it. We have to start pretty much from scratch to think about what is a social society, what's it going to look like right after revolution, where do we want to go to? These are really basically unexplored questions in both of our traditions, you know, beyond the slogans.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to pick up the Civil War thing. I think I'm kind of somewhere in between. I just wanted to bring up the semi-state idea. Just more of a question, really, just to actually clarify what you mean by a semi-state, really. I mean, listening to talking and reading some of Cibrio's stuff, it doesn't sound any dissimilar to what we would talk about in terms of workers' councils and militias, etc., in terms of like anarchist communist positions, and what the same as what the communes views are. I'm just curious to find this question.
What do you want me to do?
Just make a few brief points. I mean, the semi-state, you know, this is social democracy by Lenin. The semi-state, you need a semi-state to crush the enemies of the revolution. And that just leads to dictatorship over the working class, doesn't it? The point about liberation, liberating the working class, when you reach that point of liberation against the state, then of course the working class will be dissolved into a wider humanity, if you like. Do you need a state to crush? I mean, I do think it's naive not to think that the rich and privileged will simply walk away and allow us to allow what we want to happen to happen. Some of them will resist, but do you need a state to put them down? Or this absurd notion of a semi-state? Well, you just need a people in arms, don't you? You need a people in arms, which is not a state. I mean, if you go back, you know, Eric's point about there's a lot of things that, you know, we can't see at this point in time because we haven't reached a stage in the struggle to allow us to see clearly. So I'm going back to history again and looking at the Spanish Civil War, 1936-1937. What did the people in arms, what did the workers' militias and workers' committees from below, how did they deal with the enemies of the revolution? Well, they just went into the affluent areas and they dealt with it. So you didn't need a state to redistribute wealth. The workers from the factory went along to their rich neighbours and redistributed wealth, created more equality there in Spain. They didn't need the state. Unfortunately, some anarchist leaders decided to rebuild the state. Despite all their convictions, they didn't have enough confidence to attempt to dissolve the state. So you don't need the state. Once you start talking about a semi-state, you're lost. You're completely lost. A state is a state is a state.
Well, I didn't raise the question of the semi-state, and I wished it hadn't been raised, even if it was raised by one of my comrades. For me, it's better not to talk about it. We know what we mean. We know we're talking about armed workers' councils. They're controlled by, and in fact in Russia, there was a perfectly functioning militia all over the place before the Civil War started. When the Civil War started, which is a shooting war, and I'll come back to the concept of Civil War in a minute, it's then they started building a Red Army. The bastion of every state is its army. An army which had already disintegrated under Tsarism was then reconstituted by Trotsky, even to the point of bringing back the Tsarist generals in order to make it function more like a proper army and stop it being a workers' militia. The workers' militia is adequate to the task of destroying the ruling class. What it's not adequate to the task is fighting an imperialist war. And that's what the Russian, what became the war in Russia became an imperialist war. Lenin had hoped to get out of war, but in fact all it did was he transferred Russia's enemies from being the Germans to being the Entente powers, Britain and France. And so the war just carried on. And in that circumstance, there's no possibility of maintaining a revolution. But when I was using the word civil war, I was thinking more like a class war. If it becomes a situation like what Eric was envisaging, of two standing armies, we've lost. We only win in the civil war situation when we can get the existing forces of the state to turn their weapons on their rulers, or the weight of our movement is so great that the whole question of physical force doesn't arise. I think you're a bit utopian to think that we can peacefully go all the way to socialism. I'd like to believe it. I want to believe it. But I just when I see all the machinations of the ruling class that they've over history, and unfortunately I was a history teacher, so it weighs heavy on me. When I see all of the machinations that they impose over the, I know that they're not going to just walk away from their property. They're going to make us pay for everything. And like, if you notice this Arab Spring, it took 800 deaths before Mubarak. They stopped the shooting in Egypt. It took God knows how many in Tunisia, a few thousand. In Libya, it suddenly became hundreds of thousands. And today in Syria, we've got actually what is a proxy imperialist war in Syria,
yeah,
with everybody in both sides. So it's not really a civil war anymore. So my concept of civil war is a limited one. We don't use all the weapons that are available to mankind. We paralyse them by our mass movement and hopefully win over their forces of repression to our side. But I wouldn't expect it to be like, you know, a walk in the park. It's going to be a little bit more difficult. I just wanted, when you said to me you want to deal with the urgent problems, I didn't actually deny that. I said we have to deal with the urgent problems. We've got people who have lost £60 a month from the bedroom tax up in the northeast, and they're suicidal.
Yeah.
And keeping them alive and dealing with them, we have to deal with. But at the same time, we're not dealing with it by telling them, well, you're just an unfortunate, you're one of the undeserving poor. We're telling them the reason for this is the capitalist system, and we've got to fight this bloody system. And we've got to match our attempts to make life better in the immediate with our attempts to see what the future can bring.
But just how we get out of capitalism and we get to what we would call communism, the common ownership of the means of production, we don't really know, because it hasn't happened. It hasn't actually happened anywhere. We've got some historical examples of attempts. You know, we got the Russian Revolution, we've got the Paris Commune, we've got the Spanish Civil War, etc., etc. Now, there's been violence in all of those. I think you're right to mention Egypt, because Egypt is quite interesting. Now, what would have happened in Egypt if they'd have had local communes already active? If like this parallel system started to emerge, where people including all the people in that community that wanted to get rid of capitalism, all joining together, Marxists, anarchists, even social democrats, but they all wanted a post-capitalist society. If you had these groups and they were organised in such a way that they were truly democratic, so they were organised in a way that you would organise a post-capitalist society, a communist society for us, where everyone's equal, quality of decision making as well, not central committees and all that functions. So if you had all these local communes, councils, assemblies already there, and you had people actually just stopping work, down on strike, bringing the whole system down, would have that been a civil war? Would it have been so popular that it would have been a matter of weeks before all of a sudden you've got close to what you want? That you're not necessarily talking about arming workers, militias, and I don't know. We don't know, do we?
You said it is utopian, and I would say it's not so much. I could be right that in the sense that the reality might show that violence will come, but I think that whenever violence has come, in most cases, it has not been planned. It's actually been people. The violence has emerged from groups which were not very planned, very well organized whatsoever. The ones that were suffering more directly. I'm not suggesting that my solution might be unrealistic, but it is nevertheless the only one I can adopt for ethical reasons. It's an ethical must in my opinion, but also because as the gentleman said, you know, there is so many explosives in this world. I think it is utopian to think that an armed solution might go anywhere beyond a very small step, especially in a country like Britain, where the state is armed to their teeth and has got the most incredible sophisticated defense mechanism. You were saying that the revolution must happen today, and there is a sense of urgency. There is, addressing that is important. It means a sense of coherence. I mean, I feel that in my heart I'm becoming somehow more anarchist every day. And I tell you in which way I'm an anarchist. I'm an anarchist on an individual level. I reject institutions. And I'll make an example. I was driving my son in a car because I've got no income. So I was CARES allowance. I was driving his vehicle and I get a fine for 60 quid. And I had to go to, and I couldn't pay it in one go. I had to pay the installment. So I had to go to court and incur extra costs. And I refused to pay those extra costs. They were reduced to £15. Now, for the sake of £15, last June I was threatened with arrested imprisonment. I refused, and I went to appeal court. The appeal was rejected, and then 6 months later, the bailiff says now it's 115. That went up to 315, and then the other day, the bailiff wanted to enter my house. I went to my MP, and I threatened. And I would bloody kill the bailiff if they tried to come in my house. Then I went to the police and I told them, I just told my MP secretary that I might kill the bailiff in my house because I heard that you might come along. You know, so arrest me now because frankly I don't know what I will do. I don't wish to be violent, but I might just be. Yeah, because this is ridiculous. So £15, you want to take someone's care allowance, £315 worth of goods. So I went to see my MP and he helped me yesterday. He said he will write to the bailiffs, and as far as I can win this little battle on an individual basis, you know, my little anarchist battle is concluded for now. And I know it's not a final solution, but I think there are certain things that we need to question ourselves. Are we being coherent with ourselves while we are trying to get there? For example, for me, and it's easy for me now to say that because I used to do a wage, and that has been taken away for some reasons, yeah? But now I refuse to earn a bloody wage from because I think with the war that this country is conducting is all blood money. The way we can, you know. So we need to think very carefully. What does it mean to be an anarchist? If we accepting an ordinary wage, if we kind of, this nice shirt is actually a present from someone who I stayed at my house. You know, I can't afford by anything like that. But if we conform to certain things. If we're living at the capitalist standard, then that's a fundamental lack of coherence. So what's the point in talking about armed attack of the state if we are being inconsistent in the meanwhile? I think it's important that try to achieve a large consensus means that people can see in you a model to follow. And they can only see in you a model to follow, not if you threaten violence, but if you are coherent in the way you're living, a way of living without the state, which is sustainable.
I
we've got, I've just been told by the state earlier to wind up. Can we just, Barry, do you want to say a final word and I'll say a final word?
On this point about Marxism and historical determinism, I mean, revolutionary Marxism is open-ended, and you know, there wasn't, even Marx was saying, there wasn't one model of capitalism and every other country had to tread the same road as Western capitalism. You know, Marxism is open-ended, and the development of theory is open-ended, and it always has been. And Marx is still rethinking things right to the end of the 19th century, rethinking, reformulating, and that's our task today, to think about how we're going to destroy the state, how we're going to establish an alternative society. We haven't got all the answers, but we have to make a start. And it's not true that revolutionary Marxism is deterministic in some sense. Trotskyism certainly is full of schemas, and it's all about we have to go through all these stages. So you have to have a left Labour government or a reformist stage, and you have to promote that first. Now, you know, revolutionary Marxists don't believe in that. Like anarchists, we don't believe you have to go through some reformist stage, or you have to put your convictions on one side, and it's a matter for private discussion and not public discussion. If you look at a lot of the Trotskyist left today, you look at Left Unity, you look at the SWP, you look at the Socialist Party, it's all about, a lot of it is all about nostalgia, not a strategy, not thinking about things, not concretely. It's all about nostalgia for the spirit of 1945 and the Attlee government and a bit of state reformism, and the state giving you a few more crumbs and so on. That's their politics, but that's not the politics of revolutionary Marxism, and it's not the politics of revolutionary anarchism either. That's what we've got in common. We're against the state, and we're against the Trotskyist tradition in Britain.
I was going to add something about coherence before. I think that was a coherent ending.